Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I am your host for this weekend show. Also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, outlining day-to-day market moves and also continuing on with a lot of company updates. Even this week, a couple companies outside of the resource sector that I really would like all of your thoughts on. So please be sure to visit our website really day after day, or at least go back throughout the week and recap those daily editorials. Let's get this weekend show underway as I am chatting with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, talking big picture about the whole concept of a reopen trade or an economic reopening that does seem to be underway in the U.S. It was just a couple weeks ago that Texas announced that they were essentially lifting all restrictions. Businesses could operate at 100% capacity. I've also heard that there's, let's say, a little over a dozen other states that have very relaxed mask policies and are continuing to progress towards a more full economic reopening. Jesse, how do you see this trend if it does continue? And let's just play out that narrative that this trend is going to continue as we get more vaccines rolled out, especially in the U.S. How is this going to impact economic data, first and foremost?
Well, you know, people keep revising up the GDP estimates to numbers we haven't seen, you know, grow on the growth side since the 1960s, you know. So we're going to see a reopening boom, and it's going to be really big. But the other side of that is it's going to come with inflation also. I think, you know, there are a number of indicators to me, you know, that I look at that are pointing to core CPI pushing 3% over the next few years. Whether you're looking at, you know, small businesses who are talking about raising prices or any other, you know, commodity inflation that we've seen, core inflation is going to pick up significantly over the next few months.
Jesse, how sustainable is this reopening and some of the pickup in, let's say, inflation data? Do you think it will be just a short-term sugar high, or is this sustainable over a few years?
Well, I think, you know, the economic discussion, you know, everybody ties economic growth and inflation like puts them together like they're tied at the hip. I don't think those discussions are, or maybe that's the appropriate way to look at it. I do think that, you know, growth will fall back after the sugar high. Now, it's also possible that, you know, the Biden administration is talking about an infrastructure package, which would be another massive fiscal push that would be good for growth. But the underlying fundamentals of the economy are still not fantastic. You know, the growth probably is not sustainable, you know, above, you know, 1.5-2% longer term. Now, I think inflation is a different discussion. I do think the inflation dynamic longer term is changing dramatically for, you know, in terms of demographics and deglobalization and a lot of these things that have been disinflationary for a long period of time are potentially turning inflationary. So I think the case for stagflation, you know, over the next several years is a pretty compelling one.
Now, what about the argument that says we have already been seeing inflation through all individuals, what they have to spend money on even before the pandemic, and it's just not related or correlated to the actual data that we get from the government? Where do you stand on that argument?
Well, I mean, there's so many different types of ways to measure inflation. And, you know, there is, you know, the Shadow Stats organization, which shows, you know, if we measured inflation the same way we did 30 years ago, you know, it'd be running 5-6%. There's also, you know, the whatever it is, the Million Prices Project, I think it's called. And you know, that actually pretty much validates the numbers in CPI. I think what people don't really like about CPI currently, and it's a fair criticism, is that you know, rents are dramatically depressed, and that's basically, you know, here in the United States due to the eviction moratorium, and so we have home prices that are screaming higher. At the same time, the government's telling us the cost of living in terms of your home is actually getting cheaper. And that is actually, to me, a very short-term dynamic that is depressing CPI and unjustifiably so. That's part of why I think, you know, when the eviction moratorium is lifted and we see rents starting to, you know, merge back to home price inflation, we'll see, you know, that's going to be part of the reason for this big, I guess, increase in core CPI over the next several months.
Okay, so let's say we do get that pop in core CPI. Broadly, inflation does start to increase. What markets, what sectors do you see that benefiting most?
Well, to me, I've been getting bullish on the gold price over the past week or two, you know, probably as bullish as I've been in a couple of years since, you know, late 18 and into 19. And that's because, you know, this headwind for gold prices is going to turn into a tailwind really quickly. And that is the direction of real interest rates. And by that, I mean, I'm just looking at the 30-year treasury yield less core CPI. And so we've seen core CPI drop from 1.78% to, you know, 1.3% is the reading that came out this morning. At the same time, we've seen the 30-year treasury yield go from 1.6% back in December to, you know, over 2.3%. So, you know, it's gone up 60, 70 basis points while inflation has fallen 30, 40. So you've got, you know, the real yield has gone from negative to about 100 basis points of positive real yield. That's a major negative for gold prices. But going forward, you know, if we see a 3% reading on core CPI and the 30-year treasury yield, you know, even if it rises to 3% to match it, to me, and we get, you know, 0% real yield, that's still very, very bullish for the gold price over the next several months. And if the yield on the 30 stays here 2.25%, while core inflation goes to 3%, you know, we're talking $2,500 an ounce on the gold price in pretty short order.
So Jesse, one more quick comment regarding inflation and some of the economic data broadly that we're going to be seeing it now that we're in March and then even the next few months. The year-over-year comps are going to be completely out of whack because of the shutdown that happened really globally at around this time. How are you going to be balancing out the undoubtedly crazy swings and year-over-year comps that we're going to be seeing?
Well, you know, I think you have to look through those and imagine, you know, Stan Druckenmiller said, you know, you have to try and imagine what the world's going to look like 18 months from now, because that's what the market's pricing in. And I think the crash last year was the perfect representation of that. You know, after the March lows, the market just powered so strongly out of those lows. And we're just now, you know, a year later, starting to see why, that the markets were discounting what we're seeing now and over the next 6 months. And so in order to, you know, position yourself for what the market's going to do over the next few months, you have to look out 18 months into the future. And of course, you know, none of us have a crystal ball, but I think we can try and understand that with the economy opening back up, a lot of these stocks that have really benefited from the stay at home, you know, orders and things like that. And I'm talking about, you know, Zoom and Peloton and a lot of these other, you know, fast growing companies that really benefited from this. You know, the rotation out of those is going to continue. I do think this, what we're seeing this week is a bear market rally in those stocks. And probably we're early in the innings, you know, in the early innings of a renewed positivity for value stocks and namely those ones that are commodity focused. So, you know, energy is one that I've talked with you about many times, Corey, over the past, you know, 6 or 9 months. And I think energy stocks, yeah, are short term overbought, but over the longer term, you know, we could be looking at an oil crisis. And if that's the case, you know, $100 barrel oil is not out of the question. And if we see that, a lot of these stocks are only just starting to take off.
Okay, let's also talk about base metals too. How can base metals also play into that outlook for energy if we do also encompass some sort of an infrastructure bill that might get signed? I hate looking ahead to an infrastructure bill because I feel like we've been talking about it for years now, probably decade. But where do you stand on how those two could be tied together potentially?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just infrastructure. It's, you think about, you know, I mean, and that's very bullish for base metals and copper especially. You know, but you don't even need that. If you just think about this transition that we're trying to make to green energy, so much of that, you know, the battery production and everything that, I mean, that goes into, you know, building windmills and solar panels and electric vehicles, all of that, you know, is going to be hugely intensive on the mining and metals industry. And so to me, it's kind of ironic that, you know, all of these investors are pouring money into, you know, electric vehicle stocks and, you know, the SPACs that are targeting them and, you know, at incredible valuations. You know, Tesla is obviously the poster child. But, you know, as my friends at Research Affiliates pointed out, the entire, you know, auto sector, the market cap doubled last year. And the opportunity for electric vehicles and things, you know, obviously that cannibalizes from auto production, from combustion engines. And so the total sales opportunity didn't double. So you can't have a market where the parts are worth more than the whole. And that's what we see in the automotive industry, mostly due to electric vehicles stocks, you know, going to the moon. So, you know, it's amazing to me where you see investors pouring money into these things at valuations that are totally uneconomic and really not investment worthy. At the same time, you look at, you know, a lot of these commodity producers and things that I mean, that are left for dead or were several months ago at least, but are still really cheap. And that's probably the best way to take advantage of the transition to green energy is probably through commodities, in my view.
So, Jesse, does commodities broadly have that lure in your eyes to suck in the general public, the bigger investors that do seem right now and even in the recent past very focused on just fast-moving sectors that seem to not take into account valuations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that we're in the very early stages of a new commodities bull market, and not just that, in precious metals too. And I do think that, you know, like my friend Helene Meisler says, you know, there's nothing like price to change sentiment. It just takes a certain amount of price gains to get people interested. But as soon as you get those gains, people will be pouring money into these stocks and these sectors, you know, if they continue to perform well. And so I do think before this commodity bull market is over, before the bull market in precious metals is over, we'll see, you know, all the guys on Wall Street Bets and, you know, on Twitter, whatever, using rocket ship emojis to be talking about gold and silver and copper and all of these other things.
So, Jesse, carry it over to the broad averages then. U.S. equity markets, they went through a short little correction here, but we're bouncing back this week. Who knows? Maybe a bottom's in, but that's a very short correction. And we will, it looks like, have some stimulus checks hitting individuals' bank accounts. The potential of those driving the markets higher, we do need to consider that. Where do you see, at least in the short term, U.S. markets moving?
Well, I do think, like I said, what we're seeing is a bear market rally in a lot of these growth names. You know, the way I look at it is, you know, I was talking about the relationship of gold to real interest rates. There's a close relationship also of growth stocks relative to the S&P 500 and nominal interest rates. And the way I look at that relationship is that, you know, growth stocks performed so much better than the rest of the market over the past year or two that they essentially got to the point where they discounted negative interest rates. You know, the 10-year would have to go to like negative 1%, 1.5% to justify the outperformance of growth stocks over the past year. So there's a huge gap there. And with interest rates going the other direction, obviously not going negative, but now, you know, we saw 1.6 on the 10-year treasury note, that growth stocks are just starting to feel the pain. You know, there was a good metaphor John Authors used on Bloomberg today, where he said that, you know, it's like, you know, Brontosaurus, you know, got bit on the tail, but it takes so long to travel from his tail to his brain that that's what's going on with interest rates rising. And growth stocks are just, they still haven't gotten the full signal yet that, you know, this trade in the relative outperformance of growth is over. And there's actually a fairly large gap that they have to give back in terms of relative performance if interest rates quickly reverse lower again.
Do you see the Fed doing anything in this environment as yield or as inflation potentially jumps higher, even though they have said that they are okay with inflation moving higher, or also in the environment where yields start to come back, which seems to be more in line with what they want?
Well, yeah, I do think that, you know, that the economy and the federal government can't afford higher interest rates. If the cost of the debt went up 1%, it would, dramatically, you know, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars in additional expense to the U.S. government, which is already running at a massive deficit. So I think we're getting, I think there's a psychological, a very important psychological level that, you know, 100% of GDP represents in terms of the total amount of federal debt. We're crossing that level now if we haven't already crossed it. And to me, that's, you know, like I said, a very important psychological level where if interest rates start going up, and we're this is why we've seen the kind of, you know, flash crashes in, you know, different maturities in the Treasury market over the last few weeks, is people are starting to figure if interest rates go up, it creates a major problem for the Fed where they will be forced to even more rapidly monetize the debt, prevent interest rates from rising. And, you know, that's not a good scenario for the dollar, for Treasury investors, et cetera. So I do think the Fed can afford to allow interest rates to go up, and not just for the economy and the housing market and those things, but just because the federal government can't afford it. So the Fed is trapped. They will be forced at some point to prevent interest rates from rising too much. To me, that is the ultimate, you know, bull case for gold.
Is there any scenario that you see where the Fed could actually turn at least a little bit more hawkish? Not actually get all that hawkish, but wind back some of their easy money policies?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I've framed this debate as the Fed has to choose between the devil and the deep blue sea. The devil is, raising interest rates to fight inflation and in the process creating another asset price crash, right? Like we've seen, in the financial crisis, and we saw in the dot-com bust. The Fed knows what happens when they raise interest rates to fight inflation in the middle of a bubble. It makes the bubble burst and creates a huge economic headache, to say the least. So the Fed is very reluctant to do that. That's why they said, we're going to allow inflation to run hot. But then they risk, shunning the devil for the deep blue sea, which is allowing inflation to kind of run out of control. And I think that's the fire, you know, that they're playing with right now, which is probably more dangerous than anybody really appreciates, is if you do let inflation run hot, you do not do anything to rein it in. And inflation's really a psychological phenomenon. If consumers and investors and everybody comes to believe that the Fed's going to allow inflation to run out of control, it could become kind of a self-fulfilling thing where we all start spending more now because we know it's going to be more expensive next month, next year. That pushes more pressure on prices and reinforces that inflationary mindset. The problem is if that happens, you know, that's it forces the Fed's hand eventually to then rein in inflation and be even more aggressive in doing so. So, you know, to me, they're going to get probably, a runaway inflation and an asset price bust in the end. It's just I don't know in what order.
Well, that's a pretty actually scary consequence or result that they could be leading towards here. Final comment then, Jesse, final market to talk about, U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar has bounced. It's actually in an uptrend for this year, 2021, but seems to be maybe losing a little bit of steam in that mid-92 level. What do you think about the dollar as it plays in to the big picture here, what we've been talking about?
Well, I mean, that was the perfect segue into the dollar because, to the extent that the Fed chooses to fight inflation and allows for an asset price bust is very dollar bullish, right? I mean, that's very deflationary, and would create kind of a demand for safe haven type of activity. But to the extent the Fed goes in the opposite direction and says, we're going to allow for inflation and we're going to have to implement yield curve control in order to prevent yields from rising too far. I mean, that's very, very dollar bearish. So I do see, I think, I've been kind of counter, bullish on the dollar since really last late summer into the fall and was wrong into the end of the year. But we've seen the dollar rally finally materialize. To me, it was a lot of that was just dollar bearishness got too extended. We had too many dollar shorts and too many people betting on a crash in the dollar. But this, to me, since the start of the year, does look like a counter trend rally in the dollar. And, I do think the Fed is probably going to choose to cap yields in some way. They're already doing it in some respect where they boosted over the last 4 weeks. They've really boosted their purchases of longer term treasuries. So they're almost starting to do a twist without even making it public to the markets. But if the dollar, if they start to do this more publicly, the dollar will sniff it out and we'll see a breakdown below that 89 level, which would be a pretty big deal.
All right, Jesse, we're wrapping it up here. It's always great having you on the show, buddy. I really enjoy all of our conversations, and I really appreciate you taking time to share your outlooks on a wide range of markets with all of our audience. I'm going to be having you back on in the next few weeks, as always, to update on some of these calls. But in the meantime, Jesse, I hope you have a great weekend. Again, I appreciate all of your time, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Always a pleasure, Corey. Thanks.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. I'm going to switch focus a little bit in these last two segments, focus a bit more on a couple precious metal stocks. I realize, and I think a lot of you, even after the conversation with Jesse, understand that, look, precious metals still been under some pressure, but if we can find some good companies that offer some value or some nice growth opportunities, it can still be a very good investment. I'm chatting here with Jayant Bhandari. He is a consultant to a lot of large funds and large institutional investors in the resource sector. Now, Jayant, you and I were chatting off mic, and you brought up a company, Gold Mountain Mining, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GMTN. This company holds the Elk Gold Project in British Columbia, just outside of Merritt, so more in the southern part of BC. This is a near-term production play as well. Jayant, please give us a little update or an overview of what attracted you to Gold Mountain Mining, please.
Hi, Corey. I have known this project, Elk Gold Project, for the last 15 years, Corey. This was the first project I ever visited when I started working in the industry. The interesting thing is that this project actually used to be an operating mine, and they have very high grade gold at surface. Hopefully later this year, the management claims that they can put the project into production and the grade would be about 11 grams per ton, open pit project, and they can actually truck that rock to the Afton mine, which is actually not very far, and the grade is so good that it will be very easy to truck it. They are expecting to produce about 20,000 ounces per year, and after 3 years, they want to ramp up production for relatively lower grade rock, which is going to be about 5 grams per ton. And they are hoping to produce about 50,000 ounces per year thereafter after 3 years. So that's the kind of scenario you have. My numbers tell me that they can generate about 50% of the gold price in free cash flow pre-tax, which means that if gold price is about $1,800, they should be producing about $900 American in cash pre-tax. Of course, on that, they have to pay about 40% in corporate tax and mining tax in to British Columbian government. But this project looks very solid. And the reason I have been very interested in this project, Corey, is that about 5 years back, I tried to buy this project working for a client. And we did a lot of work on this project. We signed the CA with what used to be an earlier version of Gold Mountain. Now, the management was completely different. It was a differently registered entity. So this Gold Mountain has no relationship with the earlier Gold Mountain, except that the project is the same. So we did a lot of work on Elk Project, and we realized that not only the project itself had a fabulous value, but the fun thing was that our geologists expected that the veins that they have should actually continue on and on, which means that what we see right now is that at the current share price of $1.15 or so for GMTN, you might actually have a very good upside already. But if the veins actually continue, you have another very, very good upside if that exploration proves to be successful. So that's the fun thing about this company. I participated in the financing that they closed last week, which was at 97 cents. So I'm not suggesting to people that they should be buying at $1.15, but it's a company that they should keep an eye on, and on any weakness they should actually accumulate.
So, John, with the cash that the company raised, it was initially announced for a $5 million raise. The company ended up raising $10 million in total. Is that enough cash to bring this into production and also undertake some of the exploration in your eyes?
Yes, absolutely. So the company says that they should be able to put the project into production by later this year. And what they need to do the pre-stripping is just the equipment to do the pre-stripping. And this should cost them about $7 million, according to the PEA. So they can go into production with about $12 million that they already have in the treasury. That should be enough for them to go into production, and the cash flow should be fabulous over the first, throughout the mine, life of mine. But the cash flow should be good enough that in the first 3 years, they should be able to generate enough treasury to construct a mill on site, which will cost them about $26 million. And that mill will allow them to start processing relatively lower grade rock at the project site. And that lower grade is still fabulous grade rock, about 5 grams per ton. So this is, again, a high-grade project. The strip ratio is very high. But this was a mine earlier, so there's a lot of data to do with how the rock operates, what kind of a strip they have. So I think they should be able to design a good mining operation out of it.
So, Giant, what is the current resource then that this company is sitting on? I understand from doing a little bit of research that the company is focused on this Siswash zone, the north zone. That's where the resource is, and that's where a PEA was done back in 2020. There's a lot of other exploration potential, but give us an update on the current resource and also the opportunities to expand that resource in your eyes.
So the resources are very small. It's only about 400,000 ounce resource so far. But remember, that gives them about 50,000 ounce per year life for about 7 years after the initial 3 years of a startup. According to the geologist that I was working with when we had a CA on this project, they thought that the resources that have been identified actually should let them should be such that the veins should continue. And you, of course, can't really define thin veins over a long distance because it's too expensive to drill from surface. You have to just keep mining and keep defining new resources as you go along. So this was the view of the geologist that I was working with. They said that the known project was good enough, but the fun was going to be in the veins that will likely continue once they have exhausted what is known.
All right. So that's interesting then, Giant. In terms of the team, I recognize a couple of the names that are involved in this, especially some of the directors, and it looks like some of their advisors. But who do you know on this team? What do you have to say about who's running this show?
So this is very funny. I actually don't personally know. Well, I know Keith Minty, who was earlier with a couple of big projects in Ontario. So I know Keith Minty, who is an independent director, but I don't personally know the management of the company. But I have had several conversations with them recently because of the private placement that they were doing. And I brought a client to participate in the private placement as well. The CEO was, I was able to communicate with him. He was very responsive to my questions. And also, funnily, when I was calling him, he was sitting in a government office talking with the local administrators about permitting. So he said, I came out feeling good about the management. But again, we live in COVID days. I haven't had a chance to talk with them personally.
Yeah, fair enough. That is just the way it is. Now, regarding COVID days, it's actually a question I asked you before recording as well, is that because this project is in BC with a team in BC, or quite frankly, anywhere in Canada, they're able to more easily get to the project. I realize that company management can get to projects pretty much around the world, but some of the hurdles that they need to jump through are much greater outside of country and even entering other countries. Is there any importance that you're putting on projects right now where management can easily get to site?
Well, the funny thing is they are actually starting drilling the project. You can drive right to the project. So where the veins are visible, it's about if my memory serves me right, you can actually see it from the road. It's about maybe 50 meters or 100 meters from the road. So it's just right there. They can drive to the project. And of course, they are operating from what I know. They are starting the drilling process, which will be a large program. And they will update the PEA in the next quarter, according to what the management told me.
So, Giant, because of the strategy here to move into near-term production, and annual production, still at 50,000 ounces a year, that's a decent size. But in my eyes, that doesn't necessarily bring in outside purchasers of the company. Obviously, the exploration potential could draw some of that attention. Do you see this as a takeover target right now?
No, it's not a takeover target. The problem with this project is, Corey, that this project has been going around with several companies over the last 15 years. None of those companies wanted to put this project into production. They, of course, announced that they were going to put this project into production. They never intended to do that. The project was either for listing purposes or for spin-off purposes or for marketing purposes. They never really gave energy on putting this project into production. And when my client looked at this project, they thought that it was very easy to put this project into production. It should have gone into production. And the current management clearly is very focused on putting it into production. So unfortunately, I don't think this is a takeover target. The good thing, however, is that this company will be generating a huge amount of cash flow from hopefully next year.
Does it not worry you that this project has been passed around so much? And fine, some companies have used it as a listing project, and other companies have said that they're going to put it into production. But fact of the matter is, it hasn't been in production in the near term. So why now do you think it's going to work? Is it because of the higher gold price? Or is there maybe just the better team here? Why now?
Well, because the higher gold price doesn't make a huge influence on high-grade projects. So this project was a fabulous project even when gold price was not very high. the reason why I think this project is actually can actually go into production is because I have been following this project for 15 years, and I have my client worked on this project for quite a bit to understand this project. The problem was that the earlier managements weren't necessarily focused on putting it into production, and we were very frustrated because we actually wanted to. We made a good offer, but it never came to fruition. But we knew that this was a project that can actually and should go into production rather than just be used for spinning off or marketing or other, promotional purposes.
Okay. Well, Giant, I appreciate these insights. If anybody has any further thoughts on gold mining or any further questions for Giant regarding gold mountain mining, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. That goes for all of the companies and all the guests that I am featuring on this show. Giant, we have to wrap it up here, but I do appreciate your time. I will actually also be following up with the company. So, Giant, thanks again for your time this weekend. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am continuing to get some insights on companies from some of the analysts and newsletter writers that I respect. I had Giant on last segment. This segment, I'm bringing on Brian Lenny. He is the founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review, also writes the premium newsletter. Now, Brian, recently, just about a week or two ago, you introduced or recommended another company to your subscriber base. This company is Canstar Resources, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol ROX and on the OTCQB under the symbol CSRNF. Now, I have to ask you broadly, what initially attracted you to Canstar Resources? Just to bring everyone up to speed, the company is focused in Newfoundland on the Golden Bay project that they hold an option to acquire 100% on. So, Brian, why Canstar? Why now for you?
For me, it's quite simple. It comes down to the people. I tend to invest with people that I make money with. And the group of people involved in this company are people that I've made money with over the last 4 or 5 years. And they seemingly never disappoint. Not that this one couldn't work out, but I tend to, stick with people I know. And so that if you look at the roster of investors on this on Canstar, you'll see Altius Minerals has over a 10% position, Adventus Mining Corporation, over 20% themselves. And then the people involved, the company's led by CEO Robert Brueggemann, who is the chairman of Abra Silver. I have a history of investing with all these people and they've made me money. So that was first and foremost. Second to that, then you go to the project, and that's after I had agreed to participate in the private placement last year, that I took a closer look at the project. And the project has all the hallmarks, I think, that you look for. It's got a big land position in a really hot part of Newfoundland. For those that know Newfoundland and heard of Newfound Gold, the Gander Block specifically, which is basically stretches from the south part of the island to the north part, and it is centrally located. And it's a hot part for exploration, and with good reason. The intercepts that Newfound Gold has hit are very good. And so the Golden Bay project's at the south end of that same trend. And geologically, I think it has all those hallmarks that you look for in a good project. So those are the two basic reasons why I did the initial investment.
Now, how did the whole deal come together with Canstar and this Golden Bay project? Because you are right, Newfoundland is a very attractive area right now. How did that deal all come together? Because I understand the Canstar really just acquired that option not that long ago.
Yeah, so the original deal if you go back a little bit further, was with Adventus Mining. Adventus spun or optioned out a few of their zinc projects in Newfoundland to Canstar. And it was actually, it was bad timing. It was right when the zinc price kind of, fell from its, $1.40-ish price down to around a buck. And really, they never got any traction with those projects. And so the company sat almost like a shell. I don't even know if they had a formal management team up until basically the last, 6 months. And so what happened is the Altius Minerals is heavily involved in Adventus Mining. And obviously they've got big stakes and they want to see these companies be successful. And so when the Golden Bay project came up and they had, some people to lead the company, it was kind of a perfect storm. And so Robert took over as CEO and Golden Bay got brought in, optioned from Altius into the company. And, the rest, it's been going pretty quick. They started with an initial field program last fall. They identified two new target zones, which I think look really good. And even to take a step back further, the Golden Bay project was originally explored by Westfield Minerals back in the 80s. And there was a couple other owners in between, but Westfield did the most kind of systematic exploration. And if you look at Golden Bay, it's got, I think it's close to 90 kilometers of strike along this, along this deformation. And it's a 62,000 hectares, I believe, around there. So it's a large project with a lot of prospective ground. But Westfield really only concentrated on one little part of it. And, they went back to that historical area when they identified these two new prospects. But the soils, the channel samples came back really good. And, these initial targets, which that they'll be leading up to for its, basically its maiden drill program, as Canstar, look really good.
Let's talk about that maiden drill program then. If they have two main target zones and it is, their first time on the project, what are you expecting or what are you hoping that they can generate from that initial drill program?
I think the potential is that they replicate what they got in their channels. Like a couple of the highlights was just over 6 grams per ton over 5 meters and another of 10 grams over 3 meters. I think one of the key points to remember, because they're not only in that same Gander zone and, following that same fault structure that Newfoundgold has, but it's the same rocks too. It's the same metasedimentary rock assemblage. This is key. And, what Robert did, I think, was really, really smart. He brought in his VPX, Dawn Evans Lambswood, and she's a structural geo. She's got a ton of experience in Eastern Canada, but she was the lead author in Newfoundgold's original 43-1 technical report when they went public, I guess it would be last year. So she knows this geology. She's familiar with it. She's got the background, and then she's teamed with a really good technical team. And I think this is really the strength of Canstar. Their technical team has Dr. Lori Curtis, Dr. Lawrence Winter from Altius, and Dr. David Palmer, who people will know as the CEO of Probe. There's a lot of doctors there, and that's a lot of experience. They both technical acumen and past success. And so I'm confident that, if there is something there, these are the guys you want looking for it. And again, that's what makes me pretty comfortable, especially with Canstar at a $15 million market cap right now, that I think it's a really good risk to reward ratio.
So regarding some of those shareholders that you mentioned, Altius and Adventus, they are connected in some sense, as we know some of the management teams there. But did Adventus get their 20% position simply from spinning out the property, or did they actually partake in any of the financings?
I believe the majority of that is from the spinning or the optioning out of the properties. But I haven't looked. I'm sure they participated in that. I know that members of Adventus participated in the placement. I don't know. I'm pretty sure, though, the corporation itself probably attained that 24% position just through the option. Altius, the same thing, how they've optioned the Golden Bay project is how they acquired their shares.
Okay. Now, the company cashed up for this drill program. Do you have any insights on how big this drill program is going to be?
Not yet. They've got just over $2 million. They're going to go in and they're going to do some more localized field work at those prospects. And there's a couple, I forget what the names of them are, up to the, I think they're the northeast of the Blowout and Kendall prospect. Oh yeah, the 20 Point and Hart Hill. There's some other like more greenfield targets that I think they're going to do some work on beforehand. But it'll be Kendall and Blowout, I think, where they concentrate their drilling effort on, and they won't announce that until they finish that localized testing and they know exactly where they want to drop the drills down. And I think that's really smart to do it incremental and hopefully at a higher price. You know, this is not going to happen till the summer. And what I told my readers is I don't think, you know, with no news leading up to this drill program or the localized exploration, you know, there's no big rush to take a full position in the company. But in saying that, you know, if Newfound Gold and the rest of this area remains hot and the market does turn, I could definitely see this share price move just because of the potential in this area and, you know, more eyeballs looking at the story.
So how much of this story is simply the area play, also understanding that there's a lot of companies that rushed into Newfoundland broadly, and there are some decent management teams that are actually exploring there. So how much is a management play, and how much is the area play in your eyes?
For me, it's 100% management, regardless of where this is located in the world. I would be participating in the placement and I'd be supporting this company. Like I said, these guys I've made money with continually, and I trust them, and I know they have the technical background, you know, to push this thing forward. To me, the hot play or the Newfoundland play is just the gravy, the cream. And really what we've seen is, you know, like in these kind of circumstances, there is something to be said for that. You know, when more eyeballs are looking for stories in that, you know, that closeology, it's amazing what can happen. Now, I don't think you put any stock. I don't think you buy this company because of that. But, you know, it's one of those things that for people that, like myself, that know the people, understand the potential in the geology, which I think is there, it's a great upside potential without even, you know, getting into, you know, what the actual prospects are. So I like it.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your insights there, Brian. And if anybody has any follow-up questions for Brian regarding this company or just for the company directly, I will be reaching out to them to have them on the show. To wrap us up here, Brian, give us a little rundown of your strategy when it comes to investing in especially juniors and exploration metal stocks, because in all fairness, especially the precious metal stocks, they've been drifting lower. Everyone's debating whether this is a bottom that's being put in. Either way, there's been a lot of pressure on these stocks and a lot of attention that simply has just gone into other sectors. What is your strategy right now when it comes to either buying or selling different exploration plays?
I'd say first and foremost, you know, try not to guess where the market is headed. If you're buying the junior metals companies, be focused on them and what kind of catalysts and what they have going for them. You know, the people get so wrapped up in trying to guess where the market's headed. You know, they either don't buy or they don't sell when they need to. And you can see it happens every single time. I think you just focus on the companies, let all the other noise happen around you, be focused on what these exploration companies have, you know, moving ahead, concentrate on the best of the best, you know, go with the best people that have the best targets, in the best jurisdictions. And I think in terms of exploration, I think you set yourself up for success. Now, the other side to that is you can check all the boxes in there and still lose money in exploration. And that's the other thing to realize, that if you're going to put money in exploration companies, you need to be or accept the fact that you're going to lose. If you have 10 positions, you're probably going to lose on six, maybe five or six of them. And the other ones, you probably hit one good one and the other ones will be kind of mixed results. So if you have that, if you're able to keep that in your head and disperse your money in a way where you can have multiple plays to make sure that you use the probability to your own advantage, I think you set yourself up really well. And the other side to that is, if you get into the exploration and developers, then at least with the developer, you have a little bit of downside risk protection, because these guys usually have an existing deposit or actual metal in the ground that has possibly some economic significance. And that's really where I think, you know, investors that want to protect their downside risk should be concentrating. So that's kind of the motto that I invest by, and it doesn't really change.
Okay. Hey, Brian, I really respect the way that you invest and what you write up in your newsletter. You are very selective on the companies you write up, and you do a lot of background research. So I appreciate you sharing that research with us. Everybody, thank you for taking time to listen to this weekend show. I hope you all enjoyed the four segments of this weekend show. And also, please take some time and go back through all the daily editorials I released this week. It was another very busy week with a lot of general commentary and a lot of company-specific commentary. And please keep those emails coming, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from all of you. Everybody, have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks for having me, Corey.